Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on legal developments surrounding tithing and religious donations featuring Daniel Blomberg. Daniel is Vice President and Senior Counsel for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, where he represents a wide array of clients in matters of religious liberty. Before joining Beckett, he clerked for Chief Judge Alice Batchelder of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit and served as litigation counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. Our moderator today is Dr. James Phillips. James is a Constitutional Government Initiative Director and an Associate Professor at BYU's Wheatley Institute. He is also a fellow with the UC Berkeley School of Law's Public Law and Policy Program and an academic affiliate with the DC-based law firm Sherjaff. His scholarship has been cited by judges around the country, including at the U.S. Supreme Court, and has been covered in various media outlets. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. At any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, James, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Marco. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. And let me just add one more little bullet point to Daniel's CV here. Daniel has five kids and, quote, too many animals, which I think is great. So thank you, Daniel, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me get us started with just a little brief background, and then I'll turn it over to you, Daniel, to kind of delve into the cases with more specifics and raise some of the issues that we need to be thinking about with these cases. But we've really seen an explosion of cases around the country, a new trend that has emerged in the last few years, where members of a religious organization or former members of an organization are suing their churches and saying that they donated money, whether that was for a specific cause or more generally, such as just giving tithing to the church, and then that the church either didn't use it in the way that they thought they should have used it, the tithing or the donation, or maybe use it in a way that the church expressly said they would not use it. At least that those are the allegations. And therefore, they want their tithing money back. And these are generally brought under fraud, various types of fraud claims. And the religious organizations have kind of pushed back with a variety of defenses. And one of the common defenses that we're seeing in all these cases is the church autonomy doctrine. So with that kind of brief background, Daniel, let me turn it over to you to kind of start getting into some of the weeds.
All right, great. Well, I'm excited. We've got a lot to cover, and I feel a little bit like Inigo Montoya in The Princess Bride, where he says, let me explain. No. Let me sum up, because there's just so much to cover. And I know right from the start, I've lost a lot of my audience. You know, there's like a permanent shot, to quote Princess Bride right at the start. But I feel like those are folks I wouldn't have reached anyway. The rest of you, you're my people. Welcome. And I'll see if I can earn the rest of you back, too. So there is a lot going on here, as James was saying. We've got there's four cases pending, four in the courts of appeals, but one that's just gotten appealed recently in the Ninth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, the D.C. Circuit. One was just decided by the en banc Ninth Circuit back in January. Another one's just decided by the D.C. Circuit also in January. And then in April, and is pending for en banc review right now in front of the D.C. Circuit to see if the court's going to take it for en banc review. And then the two cases that are in front of the 10th Circuit, one was argued a year ago, and then another one's set to be set for briefing here shortly. And all of these cases deal with the same question, exactly what James is talking about, whether giving a former member of a church who gave money to the church can get it back. And there have been one set of these cases is multi-district litigation, where you have five cases that have been combined together. So in the last 5 years, you've had eight cases filed nationwide where church members are trying to get their money back from churches and on. And this is key, not because there's a wayward pastor or someone out there who's taken the money and run, but because the churches are using the money in authorized ways. You know, the church has said, yeah, this is how we want to use it. And the member disagrees with it for some reason. They disagree with that particular use. And so you've got 8 of these cases in the last 5 years challenging authorized expenditures of the church, which raises pretty severe church autonomy issues. And there's been a mixed reaction by the courts on them. For the most part, they've overwhelmingly rejected them, but on mixed grounds. And there's at least one set of cases now, that the case in the D.C. Circuit, where the courts are allowed the case to proceed at this time. So we'll go through each one of them, but that's kind of the overview of where things are. Also, one other thing to flag is that 6 of these 8 cases are putative class actions, which raises an additional layer of church autonomy question on top of everything else. And one of the things to understand, you see it particularly in the class action context, is the concern of process as punishment, right? Where even if the churches have a meritorious defense, the process of litigating about what it means to spend church funds, to understand what it means to tithe, why the church operates the way it does, things of that nature, the church's internal communications, that very process of litigation means that churches are going to change the way they function, the way they operate, simply to avoid spending years and years in court and potentially hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars just to deal with the attorney's fees that are generated in these kinds of cases. So it's a really significant burden on the work of the church to have to litigate a case about how they spend money that their own members have voluntarily given them. So let's talk a little bit about the various cases and start with, I think, James, if you want to start with the Huntsman case.
Yeah, I think that's the granddaddy of these. So.
Right. So the Huntsman case is the one that was just decided in January by the en banc Ninth Circuit. And that case starts from a fairly illustrious member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a well-known member of the church by the last name of Huntsman. That family goes back generations and generations within the church. And he claims that his church spent $2 billion on a shopping mall revitalization and a life insurance company bailout, and despite having publicly represented that, quote, not one penny of tithing would go to for-profit endeavors, including specifically the shopping mall revitalization. That was his claim. Now, the church says, no, that's not what was going on. That's not what we said. In fact, the money that we spent was from earnings on invested tithes. So we received tithes from members of the church. We invested them. And then the money that we spent came from the earnings on those investments. That case has been pending for a while. It went to the district court. The district court rejected it, was appealed to the Ninth Circuit. A panel of the Ninth Circuit split and revived the claim and said, yeah, we think that this is a cognizable claim for fraud. You said you weren't going to spend the money on this. A reasonable juror could think that you spent the money on it. And so, you know, this is the neutral principles of law that would apply to any other organization, apply to you, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and how you spend your money. And so the case can go forward. That case then went en banc, and Paul Clement was hired by the church to handle the case at the en banc stage, and the court unanimously rejected the claim. And it's really interesting how they did. So there are 11 members of the en banc court, as you recall. The Ninth Circuit's so big they don't see all members of the court on their en banc court. They have an 11 member panel. 6 members said that the claims failed on their face. There had been some very limited discovery, but only really just enough to get the testimony of the plaintiff, and that was it. And then a couple of declarations that were filed by both sides. And the court said, based on that record, there was no claim here. 5 judges said, yeah, there's no claim here, but there's no claim here under the church autonomy doctrine. And we'll get into that in just a second. Okay, so those first 6 judges said that no reasonable juror could have understood tithing to mean what Huntsman thought, which is, I'm giving you the money, and any money that I give you is tithing. And no matter what you do with it after that, it's still tithing. The court said, given the context provided by the church's other statements about how it used and invested earnings on invested tithes, that there was just no fraud. There was no fraud there. So that's how 6 members of the court would have resolved the case, or did resolve the case. And they said, no church autonomy problem for us to resolve it like this, for us to come in and say, there's this claim fails at this stage, essentially right at the beginning, because again, you hadn't had any discovery yet, except into the plaintiff's own deposition. That was it. And six judges said, there's no problem for us to say right now that this claim fails and nothing else has to happen. Four judges, in an opinion by Judge Bress, agreed with that. They said, yeah, this claim fails right now, and we think it fails on those grounds. And we also think it's not a church autonomy problem for you to say that right now. However, they said, you should have gone on and said more, because it would be a church autonomy problem for this case to go any further, for it to take one more step, because the claims at issue here inherently require entangling the power of the government with the function of the church. And they specifically pointed to things like the elements of proving a fraud claim. Like, you have to prove reasonable reliance, justifiable reliance. And you couldn't prove that without knowing why a reasonable member of the church would give tithes in the first place. And so you would to know whether or not they would have been dissuaded from giving tithes by knowing how this money was going to be spent. Or, you know, going in and evaluating a religious sermon for accuracy. I mean, these were the allegedly fraudulent statements were in part statements made by the president of the church in the context of religious services to the two members of the church. And Judge Bress said it's kind of the height of entanglement to go in for federal courts to say, you should have been a little more precise when you were saying how you were going to use the tithes. Now, so that was four of the judges who concurred in dismissal. So they agreed that the claim should go out on their face, like the other six judges. So you had 10 judges said claims go out in their face. Then these four judges say they also go out under the church autonomy doctrine. And then the final judge, Judge Bumate, wrote an opinion that said they should only go out under the church autonomy doctrine. He said church autonomy is a threshold issue with a structural right. That structural right requires courts to resolve it first before you get into anything else, because you don't want to be mucking around the church's internal affairs. You don't want to let the process become the punishment. And so right here, since we can see on the face of these claims and where they're going to go, these claims are barred right now. And that's all we should have to say. And that's all we should say in resolving this case. So 11-0, the Huntsman Court threw out the claims. And that's how that case got resolved. James, any questions or thoughts on that one?
Yeah, so a couple thoughts. So I think this may have come up in the Judge Bumate's concurrence, but the six in the majority, so to speak, although it was unanimous on the judgment, they kind of parsed the church leaders' statements on this is what the definition of tithing is, and then kind of compared it to what Huntsman thought and said, well, we're going to go with the church here. We think that the Huntsman's understanding of the church's definition is just not really reasonable. Does that create any church autonomy concerns in doing that kind of parsing, or is that just more reflecting deference to the church? Kind of where's the line? At what point can a court come in and say, well, here's what the church officially says, we defer to them, versus, no, we're going to parse this a little bit.
Yeah, well, what Judge Bumate says is what the majority was really doing was actually employing the church autonomy doctrine. And so they said they didn't have to get into it, but in fact they were, because when they came in and said no reasonable juror could possibly understand the statement that not one penny of tithing is going to that shopping mall, the only way you do that is by deferring to what the church said about what they meant and putting that statement in context of what the other things the church had said. So Judge Bumate thinks that the majority actually did engage in church autonomy analysis, and frankly, in some ways, properly gave deference to the church's leadership when it was talking about what tithing is, which of course is a religious concept that has deep, deep roots in many different faith traditions.
Yeah. He also kind of explored a little bit of how is church autonomy a threshold issue, and what way is it quote unquote jurisdictional. And he kind of explored, is it more like kind of Article III standing? Does it go to the jurisdiction of the court? And then, or is it more kind of like sovereign immunity that you can, it's not a sua sponte thing the court might raise, but if you raise it, then we treat it as kind of jurisdictional. And of course, I think Justice Thomas is also hinted at some of these things in a recent case called Catholic Charities Bureau. You know, how do you read the Bumate concurrence and Justice Thomas on this? And which way do you think is the way court should be going on this?
Well, I mean, there's a fascinating discussion between Judge Bress and Judge Bumate in the Huntsman opinions, where Judge Bress says, you know, I don't think, you know, as a claims ordering matter that we have to necessarily resolve a case that raises church autonomy issues on church autonomy grounds, if there's another way we can address it and resolve it without getting into the church autonomy questions, right? So because we can resolve it now on non-church autonomy grounds, I'm okay with that. So he gives a thumbs up to the six judge majority opinion. And Judge Bumate says, no, you can't do that because it is a threshold issue. What's interesting about Judge Bumate's move is he doesn't say it's jurisdictional. He doesn't say that it's absolutely like jurisdiction. And I think that's probably the right call. What he says is you should treat it akin to jurisdiction, akin to an immunity, akin to, say, separation of powers. Or is this something you resolve at the threshold of a case as soon as you possibly can to prevent a violation of the structural separation that the Constitution puts between church and state, right? It says this church has the right and the freedom to resolve its own questions of faith, doctrine, and internal governance. And if you're doing a lot of litigating over faith, doctrine, and internal governance, then you're not respecting that independence. They're not independent. And so it should be at least like a form of immunity or a form of separation of powers, where you resolve that question at the front end without getting into the merits of the claims. And interestingly, Justice Thomas does seem to see some purchase with that in his recent concurrence in the Catholic Charities Bureau case that came out just a couple weeks ago. And
he's been a win for Beckett, I might add. So,
yeah, well, and you bring up a fair point. I'm not a disinterested observer in these cases. Beckett filed an amicus brief in the support of the church in Huntsman. We filed an amicus brief in support of the church in Gaddy. I'm counsel in the D.C. Circuit case called O'Connell that we'll talk about in just a second. And Beckett, yeah, was involved in Catholic Charities. So these are all cases that we spend a lot of time thinking about. And of course, James's firm also is involved in all these cases. They filed amicus briefs in Huntsman and Gaddy and the multi-district litigation. And then James's colleague, Gene Scher, argued in the multi-district case and in the Gaddy case. So again, his firm is spending a lot of time thinking about these cases. So, you know, stepping back, you know, full disclosure, we're all thinking about this a lot. And then here in this context, you know, Justice Thomas really gives a lot of credence. In fact, he in the way his opinion reads, is it reads a lot like he sees the church autonomy doctrine as jurisdictional. But even if you don't accept that, and, you know, Judge Bumate says it's kind of neither here nor there, the important thing is that it should be resolved at the threshold of case, whether you see it as jurisdictional or not.
Well, great. Well, that probably is a good segue into O'Connell, unless there was more about Huntsman that you wanted to talk about.
No, I know. I think that's great. So O'Connell is another fascinating case. This is a case that was filed on behalf of a member of a Catholic church who said that he gave a religious offering in response to an invitation from the pulpit of his Catholic parish during Mass to give to a 1,000-year-old religious offering within the Catholic Church known as Peter's Pence, where the money goes to the Pope. So it's not going to the parish. It's not going to other intermediate religious organizations within the church. It's going to the Pope. This is what the offering is for and what it has been for over 1,000 years. And specifically, he said the invitation was to support the, quote, charitable works of Pope Francis. And then he understood that, he alleges, to mean that the money was going to go directly, specifically, exclusively to taking care of poor people in distressed places around the world. And when he found out that some of the money, a good percentage of the most of the money was put into investments and also used to keep the Vatican running, he said, that's not a charitable work. I don't think that's charitable. I think that's, you know, you've committed fraud. And so he sued under fraud and theories related to fraud, saying that he had been misled. And now he doesn't actually say precisely what he heard in the church service or precisely who said it. In fact, he doesn't sue the Pope, who is the one who used the money, and he doesn't sue his parish, which is the one who solicited the money from. Instead, he sued the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops because they put out some suggested materials that parishes can use if they want to use them in encouraging people to contribute to this 1,000-year-old offering to the Pope. And he said, the USCCB is liable for what I think I heard and what I understood it to mean at that mass, at that time when I dropped some money in the offering plate. And they're not just liable to me, they're liable to all the other Catholic faithful around the country who have my interpretation of what Peter's Pence is and how Peter's Pence should be used. And unlike the other cases that have gone on in this case, in this context, right? So like Huntsman, the district court rejected that case, the multi-district litigation, the district court rejected the theories of fraud there, and the Gaddy case, which we'll talk about in a minute, in the 10th Circuit, district court rejected it there. All those cases have been thrown out essentially at the threshold. Here, the district court said, I think this case can go forward. I think we can go forward to class action discovery, merits discovery. I don't think there's a church autonomy problem in determining, you know, what a reasonable Catholic would have understood this invitation to mean. And that's something that at least at this stage of the case, I can adjudicate. We will continue. We can raise the issue later, but right now, no problems for the case to go forward. At that point, the church, USCCB, appealed to the D.C. Circuit and said, hey, D.C. Circuit, if this case goes forward, you are going to be getting into our internal religious affairs. Look no further than the discovery requests that we've seen that say we need to give all of our communications between us and the Pope and the parishes about Peter's Pence, and also lists of all of the folks who contributed nationwide to Peter's Pence. We need to turn all that stuff over in this litigation pursuant to the exercise of your judicial power. That can't be right. That can't be constitutional. And they asked the D.C. Circuit to take the case. The D.C. Circuit heard argument on that in January and then rejected it in April and ruled that it was premature for USCCB to come up, that the church autonomy doctrine doesn't provide any sort of protection from the very process of litigation, and that the USCCB could be fully protected in their church autonomy rights after the conclusion of trial and the whole process of litigation in the district court. And so that's where that case is right now. We've sought en banc review from the D.C. Circuit, filed that in late May, and the D.C. Circuit has ordered a response from the plaintiff, which will be coming in next week.
So, Daniel, let me ask a few questions about this. It seems like perhaps this case, and unless I'm factually misunderstanding it, is also a little bit different than some of the other cases that we're going to talk about today, in the sense that there was this understanding of what was kind of said over the pulpit in one particular location. And you can imagine that there are pulpits around the country with Catholic priests talking about Peter's Pence. This is a lot different than, say, an authoritative statement by the leader of the church to all of the faithful in a churchwide gathering. This seems really piecemeal. How does that implicate or interact with the church autonomy doctrine here?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's all the church autonomy problems that Judge Bress and Judge Bumate identified in Huntsman, except on steroids, right? You're still going to be asking the questions about what would a reasonable Catholic have understood it to mean when they were invited to give to Peter's Pence from the pulpit during Mass to an offering that's been going on for 1,000 years and used by the Pope in certain ways throughout that time. You know, there's lots of Catholic teaching, lots of letters from the Pope about how the money has been used throughout that 1,000 years. It's not consistent with what the plaintiff is saying in this particular case. And then you've got not just that plaintiff and his understanding and what he alleges he may have heard. Again, he doesn't tell us exactly or how much he put in the plate exactly in Rhode Island when he dropped the money in the plate. But he wants to represent a class nationwide of all faithful Catholics who have dropped money in the plate and who share his, frankly, idiosyncratic understanding of how the Pope was going to use the money. And so, you've got a really substantial, significant church autonomy problem right on the face of this case, and it's inescapable. right? He's got to prove these claims. And he's even said that. He said, my case can't go forward. I cannot succeed unless I get all of these internal communications so I can prove up these this theory of liability.
So there's a question from one of our attendees that I think ties in here, and a question that I had about, can there be any discovery that doesn't violate church autonomy here? And the question is, when you referred to deciding the issue at the beginning as a threshold issue, does that mean only on the pleadings under Rule 12, or might it mean after some discovery under Rule 56?
So that's a great question. Yeah, that's a great question. I think probably the easiest way to understand the answer to that one is to look at the ministerial exception, right? This is the aspect of church autonomy that more folks are comfortable with or more familiar with. There's a fair amount of case law on it in the lower courts. The U.S. Supreme Court has resolved it twice in the last 13 years in the Hosanna Tabor case and the Our Lady of Guadalupe case. And in that context, there's a lot of cases, actually many, many cases, where the plaintiff's pleadings on their face show that the individual is a minister. He's coming in and says, hey, I was fired because of my age or my sex or some other reason that's protected under employment non-discrimination law. And you know, I was a minister of this church. I was the pastor, the priest, I was a rabbi. I was an imam. And on the face of the pleadings, then you can determine ministerial status. And because and you can also determine that the religious body was the defendant is a religious body. And you can see that the claims arise under the types of theories that are barred by the ministerial exception. It's all right there. And so in that context, courts have regularly rejected the claims right at the threshold. Some good examples of that come up at the en banc Seventh Circuit in a case called Dimkovich from just a couple of years ago. The Alcazar case out of the Ninth Circuit, all resolved on the pleadings at the very front of the case. But not every case can do that. Sometimes the pleadings are ambiguous as to the religious duties or role or status or expectations of the particular plaintiff who is suing a religious defendant over employment discrimination related matters. And so in that case, what courts will do to prevent intrusion onto the church autonomy right is they will bifurcate the case. They'll bifurcate the proceedings and say, we're only going to do discovery into the religious functions or religious role or expectation of this minister. We'll get that resolved. But we will not go into why the religious body made their employment decision. That's off limits. If this person's a minister, we as courts aren't allowed to look at that. We're not allowed to touch it. We're not allowed to examine it. So all we're going to ask is the question, just get enough information to resolve whether this person was a minister based on very limited factual discovery. And a good example of that is the Fratello case out of the Second Circuit, where the district court denied an initial motion to dismiss, set the case for bifurcated discovery, and then ruled for the Archdiocese of New York and a Catholic school after discovery showed that the individual was a minister. So not every case that raises church autonomy issues is going to get resolved on the pleadings. Sometimes you'll need to do a little bit of discovery, but bifurcated discovery, limited discovery on just the church autonomy issue. A lot of cases, though, like Alcazar, like Dimkovich, and like a fair amount of other ones, can be resolved in the pleadings, and they should be, because if you can resolve them on the pleadings, going further than that taxes the exercise of church autonomy by the church.
Great. In the O'Connell, in the D.C. Circuit's opinion, they talked about how, you know, as they saw it, at least right now, that this dispute could be resolved on neutral principles of law. And so they were going to let it go forward. They didn't see a church autonomy problem necessarily. I believe Professor Carl Esbeck, if I recall correctly, has written that the neutral principles kind of approach to resolving disputes that seem to involve religious entities and religious individuals should only apply and has only been applied by the Supreme Court in the property dispute context. And then it's actually would be a mistake to expand it beyond that. Do you have any thoughts or reactions to the neutral principles and when it can be properly applied without violating church autonomy?
Right. So the neutral principles approach was developed precisely for issues where you have two religious bodies that both say, I'm the real church and that's my building. Right. So, you know, you have a schism. And one, the original church body is broken into two church bodies and they both want their place to meet. And both sides are saying, hey, I'm the real church, you know, and the court's kind of stuck in the middle. You got a piece of property. It needs to be, you know, somebody needs to have ownership of it. And so the court is looking for a way to resolve that particular type of dispute where you've got both sides saying, I'm the real church, defer to me. And so it's a fundamentally different type of issue than, say, in the ministerial exception context, where you've got a minister suing the one church and only one church and saying, no, I wasn't a minister, defer to me on what my ministerial status was. And courts say, no, we're not going to do it that way. And the Supreme Court has expressly rejected using the neutral principles approach in the context of the ministerial exception and in other situations where you've got what's really a dispute about church faith, doctrine, or governance, and it has implications for property control. So Milivojevic in the 1970s is an example of that, where you had two bodies kind of tussling over a piece of property, but fundamentally what they weren't, it wasn't about the property, it was about who can reorganize and control the diocese and who can be the real bishop. And the court said, even though there's implications for property, this is really a church governance dispute. We don't use neutral principles outside the property context to resolve a church governance dispute. Now, some lower courts have seen it otherwise. There are courts like the Second Circuit in the Balia case has said, actually, sometimes we do apply the neutral principles approach in tort claims, like the claim for defamation, which is what was at issue in Balia. That has been very controversial. There are 15 judges who have issued opinions in the last several years saying that's the wrong way to approach that kind of issue, including an opinion by Judge Park that was joined by Chief Judge Livingston, Judge Nardini, Judge Menasche, and Judge Sullivan in the Balia case, dissenting from the Second Circuit's decision there, saying that this eviscerates the church autonomy doctrine, right? You're taking an approach that was meant for a specific type of dispute and frankly meant to protect church autonomy within that dispute, trying to find the narrowest way to resolve this dispute when you've got two sides saying we're both the real church, and you're importing that into a very, very different situation, and you're forcing the church to spend years litigating their own, you know, religious beliefs, their own religious governance, in ways that is deeply harmful and deeply entangling, which both violates the duties of courts to stay out of church issues and chills the exercise of religious bodies in their internal governance choices.
Thank you. I noticed that the D.C. Circuit rejected some analogies to kind of speech cases where I think it was kind of the right to speak during trial was being infringed. And in those cases, in interlocutory appeal, the collateral order doctrine was allowed. And I was just wondering, is there any kind of chilling effect on the USCCB and how it advertises Peter's Pence? While this litigation is ongoing, does it have to lawyer up, the sermons in the way they describe Peter's Pence and the donations and how they're going to be used? And is there any analogy there with that kind of way that it's going to affect the church's speech while this litigation's ongoing?
Yeah, I mean, to ask the question is practically to answer it, right? I mean, if you're getting sued over how you talk about a 1,000-year-old offering to the Pope, and, and you're facing millions and millions of dollars in liability potentially, and lawyers fees and paying your own lawyers just to be able to exercise, church governance questions and things like that. Of course, it's going to be an issue. Of course, it's going to be an issue. And you see this in a variety of different cases. And that's why there's also a burgeoning split on this particular issue of interlocutory appeal. The same group of judges from the Second Circuit said, no, you can't force the church to go through to the end of trial before it can get an appeal, because that's going to chill its religious governance when you've got the government jumping in like that and using judicial power to dig through and rummage through the beliefs of the church. And they point to a series of cases, Milivojevic won, the NLRB versus Catholic bishop case, where the U.S. Supreme Court said the very process of litigation, the very process of inquiry, is a burden on rights guaranteed by the religion clauses when you're digging into issues of church governance, right? And it's not just those Second Circuit dissenters. Judge Brennan on the Seventh Circuit disagreed with a recent decision that ruled otherwise, and Judge Bacharach and Timkovich and Ide on the Tenth Circuit all disagreed with a contrary decision on related issues recently. So there's a lot of cases that are talking about these questions, and a lot of judges that are talking about these questions, and disagreeing with where the D.C. Circuit landed on it.
Yeah, it seems like the O'Connell case, perhaps more so than the Huntsman case, really sheds light on how much this potentially could infringe on internal decision making. I mean, the way the Huntsman case was resolved, they basically said, oh, there's no fraud here. Like they said, we're not using tithing on this. And according to the way the church defined it, they didn't. But here we have Peter's Pence was supposed to go for, you know, the church to use for the poor. And the church, in its wisdom, said, well, we need to invest some of this, right? I mean, because we want to take care of the poor long term, and we never know what's going to happen. And so, you know, do we have to spend it for the poor today, or can we spend it for the poor in 10 years or 15 years because we've got this ability to continue to spend money? So any thoughts or reactions on how this really interferes with a church's flexibility to make decisions on how to use its funds?
Right. Well, and the contrast between Huntsman and this case is really remarkable, right? In Huntsman, you have 11 judges in the Ninth Circuit said case can't go forward. It's a really big problem. And the six judge majority, which are joined by the four judge opinion by Judge Bress, said, so you get 10 judges saying, you got to look at the context of the statements and determine from that context what a reasonable judge or juror would have considered here. And they said, and all of us agree that no reasonable juror could possibly understood tithing to mean what you think it means. Well, here you've got 1,000 years of context. You've got church teaching, church letters from the Pope. You've got all sorts of church documents showing what this context has meant, and lots of church history, all of which is in front of the D.C. Circuit, showing exactly that kind of context and showing, frankly, a lot more context for how the Pope has always used the money in a variety of different ways to meet the needs of the church as he saw fit, including as he did here and in times past, to take care of the needs of the poor. There's a very sharp conflict between how the D.C. Circuit is thinking about this and how the Ninth Circuit is thinking about it, especially when you look at the five judges who said this is absolutely a church autonomy problem. You can't go a step further in this case without inherently getting into religious issues. And of course, remember, Huntsman had one deposition and a couple of declarations, and that was it as far as discovery goes. So you're essentially at the same stage of the case as we are in O'Connell. And we have more than enough in the public record and in the pleadings, because the pleadings say I was concerned about I was confused about what it meant to give to the charitable works of Pope Francis. Charitable works is a pretty broad term, and it's particularly broad when you understand that charity is a theological term and a theological concept within Catholic teaching. And again, that's the kind of thing that you see in the Catholic Charities case. And Judge Justice Thomas's concurrence spends a lot of time talking about the breadth of the understanding of the term charity and what it means in the Catholic context. And all of that should be more than enough to say that context shows we're getting into severe church autonomy problems here. And you can't wait until after class action discovery and merits discovery and a merits trial to make the determination that what we can see right now is going to come to pass. This is a church autonomy problem.
Well, unless you've got anything more on O'Connell, should we pivot to Gaddy, which is in some ways a bit broader than Huntsman and O'Connell in the claims that are being made?
Right. I think the important thing to realize with both Gaddy and with the five cases that have been consolidated in the multi-district litigation coming out of the District of Utah, those cases are Utah, Illinois, Washington, Tennessee, and California. They were all consolidated together into the District of Utah. All of those cases essentially are raising the same thing that the Huntsman case did. You know, you told us you were going to use the tithe for this. You end up spending on the shopping mall. We think that's fraud. Give us our money back. And federal court, you order them to give us our money back. Oh, and by the way, our attorney's fees. Oh, and by the way, we want to do this in the case of the multi-district litigation as a class action, right?
Daniel, there was one other wrinkle in the multi-district litigation that was kind of mind-blowing. They also wanted a special master appointed to oversee the church's spending of money, and that it was properly within what they had said they were going to spend it on. It was just kind of incredible to think that a special master could be appointed to supervise a church's use of its donations.
Right, right. Well, and in the Gaddy case had another wrinkle as well. I mean, the heart of the cases are the Huntsman, you know, the Huntsman dispute. Yeah. But you're right, they have these other elements of them. And Gaddy, you've got the plaintiff arguing that the church, quote, and this is quoting from the brief on appeal, the church misrepresented the process by which the Book of Mormon was created, and also misrepresented, quote, misrepresented the character of its, quote, founding prophet, Joseph Smith. I don't understand how federal courts are supposed to touch that. I don't understand how federal courts are supposed to have a conversation about that, to say that you there's some sort of misrepresentation, there's some sort of civil law problem with how you compile your holy writ and how the, you know, the conduct of the founding prophet of a religion. I mean, that's just remarkable that this kind of litigation is ongoing, but it is, and churches are being forced to defend against it. Now, in both cases, the district courts, again, rejected these theories at the threshold and said, now you can't move forward with them. In fact, the multi-district litigation out of Utah said, I'm going to reject it on four different grounds. And not church autonomy. They said, kind of taking the path that Judge Bress had articulated, I don't have to resolve church autonomy now. And since I can resolve this case at the pleading stage on other grounds, I'm going to. And then he rejected it on statute of limitations, the lack of fiduciary relationship, failure to plead reliance, which is involved in all these kinds of claims, and failure to plead materiality of the non-disclosed info. And so the court said, for all those reasons, this case is gone, and threw it out on that, on those grounds. And so in a way, you know, O'Connell really is the outlier. Everything else has gotten resolved at the pleading stage, or something very close to the pleading stage. It's only O'Connell that's being sent forward into merits discovery and putative class discovery in that respect. So I think that the big thing, the big nuances of the MDL case and the Gaddy case, the ones we just mentioned, but they also have been resolved at the threshold. Now, Gaddy was argued a good bit ago, and the ruling on that, I expect we'll get any day now. What was it? I think it was last September that the argument was, right around the same time the Huntsman argument was, I believe, and where Paul Clement argued. And then the MDL was resolved in March 2025. And is now up on appeal in front of the 10th Circuit. So we don't have the results on appeal in those cases yet. But the district court, you know, they were resolved at the threshold.
So one thing that was interesting with Gaddy is the kind of claims about the church misrepresenting the process of its writ being created, or things about its founder, or so forth. Those, it was interesting there, the district court was willing to say church autonomy, sorry, we can't do this. But on the kind of fraud tithing donation aspect, it wasn't church autonomy. It was resolved on alternative grounds. And so we have yet to see either a district court judge or a majority of a panel resolve these donation tithing issues on church autonomy. They've always resolved them on alternative grounds. Any thoughts on why that is, or why courts seem to be engaging in maybe a type of constitutional avoidance here?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what's going on is that courts are very familiar with fraud claims. They're very familiar with fiduciary duty and unjust enrichment claims. And so they're comfortable with rejecting claims on those kinds of grounds. They're not as familiar with church autonomy. You saw this in the whole women's health case in the Fifth Circuit a few years ago, where you had a district court order discovery required all the bishops and Catholic bishops in Texas to turn over all their communications for like 60 years to a bunch of abortion providers. And all those communications, internal communications being on abortion. And the Fifth Circuit ultimately rejected that and said, now you can't do that. And one of the things that the court pointed to is like, listen, in the church autonomy context, we're not as familiar with this. This is something that is a little bit harder for courts to kind of get their heads around and to understand how it applies. So I think that's part of what's going on. But I also think that, you know, the opinions by Judge Bress and Judge Bumate, and then the ones that I mentioned earlier, the Second, Tenth, and Seventh Circuits, indicate that courts they are pretty familiar with it, and increasingly so as we're seeing this kind of new class of claims arising.
In the Gaddy case, it might have been in a footnote, I don't recall, but the district court judge said churches may not invoke the doctrine, church autonomy doctrine, to shield purely secular decisions. And I wonder if that perhaps draws a line that doesn't always exist for religious organizations. From the outside, something might look like a purely secular decision, but it could be driven by religious reasons or motivations. I think we saw some discussion of this a little bit in the Catholic Charities Bureau context where, this may look secular and secular organizations may make similar decisions or engage in similar conduct, but this very much is arising out of the faith of a particular organization. Any thoughts on this kind of purely secular versus spiritual divide that courts are sometimes proposing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that Catholic Charities Bureau addresses that kind of issue because the Wisconsin Supreme Court, divided Wisconsin Supreme Court, has essentially resolved it along those kind of lines until the Supreme Court unanimously said, "Nah, that's wrong." They said, "Yeah, we think that, you know, taking care of the poor isn't inherently religious. And so it is purely secular and we can resolve it along those kind of grounds." You see that a lot in the cases that are going the wrong way on church autonomy issues. And oftentimes what they'll do is say the issue has to be purely ecclesiastical for courts to stay out. So if it's purely ecclesiastical, we'll stay out of it. But and so you kind of put the burden on the church to say that, you know, that there's no secular component to this whatsoever. But of course, I mean, everything's going to look secular to a federal district court judge that deals with this sort of stuff all the time. And the Supreme Court rejected that kind of thinking in Hosanna-Tabor, where it was a kind of a similar idea that you need a stopwatch to determine who a minister is. And if that individual is doing too much administrative work and secular work throughout the course of the day, then they're not a minister. And said, listen, even the Pope has a lot of administrative duties. That doesn't mean that he's not a minister. And I think that so the putting the onus on religious bodies to prove, hey, this is purely ecclesiastical is backwards. I think it's actually better to say that unless the dispute here is purely secular, there is no religion on its face and there's no religion by implication that you're going to be, you know, again, chilling the ability of the church to govern itself. Then in that context, yeah, maybe the claim can proceed. But that's not what we're dealing with here. I mean, all of these cases are church members or former church members suing their churches over how the churches are spending money for church authorized uses. And so religion is just inescapable in the context of resolving claims like this.
Yeah. You know, professor at George Mason Law, at Scalia Law, named Donald Koshin has written about how what we call clauses or doctrines matters because mm-hmm. it shapes how we perceive them. And he said, take, for example, the takings clause. What if we called it the just compensation clause, right? It kind of shifts the framing. And I've wondered if maybe church autonomy is not broad enough. Maybe it should be the church autonomy and immunity doctrine. Perhaps that would help with some of these questions. Let me ask one more question, and then we've got a few in the queue here from our audience. Some of our listeners may be wondering, okay, well, where's the line? Can the law ever hold a religious organization responsible for fraud? I think Judge Brass maybe hints at some possibilities in his concurrence, but what are your thoughts on that?
Sure, they absolutely can. And this came up in oral argument in the Huntsman case, and Paul Clement, I think Judge Friedman was asking about this, and his response is, yeah, I mean, if you've got a pastor who says, give me your money so I can give it to the orphanage, and then he takes the money and buys a Rolex, and essentially is converting the money, taking the money from the church. And yeah, there's no question that's a fraud claim. And there have been lots of cases that have addressed it along those types of grounds. What you're dealing with here, though, are situations where the church is saying, you know, this is an authorized expenditure of the church. We do want the money to be put in investment. We do want to keep the Vatican's lights on in the case of the O'Connell case. That is important to the charitable works of the church. And so you've got the plaintiff coming in and saying, well, I want a federal court to say that I'm right in disagreeing about what the charitable works of Pope Francis are, right? That is not something that falls on the secular side of the line. That is something that obviously falls on the religious side of the line.
Great. Well, here's a couple of questions that are related.
Before we get your point about nomenclature, I think is really important. And this is a developing issue. Actually, this spring, we're seeing it really moving. And that for a long time, state courts have primarily called the doctrine the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine. Mm-hmm. You see that in some federal courts as well, though not as many. And they're mostly older decisions. That is overwhelmingly shifting. You saw it in the Huntsman case. It was called church autonomy the whole time. You saw it in an oral argument. I think Justice Kagan referred to the doctrine several times, the church autonomy doctrine. Justice Sotomayor's opinion in CCB, Catholic Charities Bureau, describes the doctrine as the church autonomy doctrine. And then Justice Thomas's opinion talks about church autonomy. And I think that's a significant shift and a helpful one. This isn't just an abstention. This isn't just judges saying, I think I'll sit this one out. This is an autonomy. This is a space that is reserved for the church to govern itself. And the Seventh Circuit has said this in the Dimkovich case and later in the Starkey case, that the church autonomy doctrine really means what it says. And that is matters of faith, doctrine, and church governance are off limits for secular courts. So anyway, sorry, please go on to the questions, but I wanted to pick up on that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So here are two related questions. Don asks, is the issue establishment clause or free exercise clause, or is it common law such as spousal or parental immunity in tort? The relationship with the donor is contractual, so jurisdiction over contract interpretation is critical to such claims. And then Jeffrey asks, listening to the discussion of the church autonomy doctrine and presuming it's rooted in the First Amendment, is it essentially or largely a constitutionalization of common law charitable immunity? So any responses to those two related questions?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is independent. The Supreme Court has been really clear that the religion clauses together, the free exercise and the establishment clause together, work together to protect church governance in unique ways. So it's not like free exercise. You're not doing the Smith analysis where you're asking questions about whether a law is neutral and generally applicable and can it pass strict scrutiny. No, the court has said over, repeatedly, not just in these recent cases, but also in the older cases like Milivojevic, that if the both clauses are working together, if this is a church governance issue, then there is no neutral and generally applicable component to the analysis. Instead, the question is this church governance? If it is church governance, then case closed, we're done with it. And there's no strict scrutiny tail. There's no opportunity for the government to say, yeah, but I have a really good reason to tell the church how to spend its money. That's just, it's off limits. And so you see parallels in other areas of law. I think then Judge Gorsuch in the Hobby Lobby opinion for the 10th Circuit, I think I'm remembering this correctly, compared, analogized the ministerial exception to freedom of association principles. And certainly Justices Alito and Kagan did that in their very influential Hosanna-Tabor concurrence, where they said, yeah, we can look at associational principles and derive a lot of contours for how the doctrine works. So is there some relationship to charitable immunity principles? Yeah, certainly, no question. But the doctrine itself that we're talking about here with the church autonomy doctrine is rooted in that recognition that religious bodies have a space in which to govern themselves on matters of faith, doctrine, and church governance. And the civil courts don't have a role in second guessing that.
Great. Here's a couple of other related, one's a question and one's kind of a comment. So I'll share those and then you can respond. The question is, this is from John, if it reaches the summary judgment stage, what happens then if there are disputed issues of fact on the threshold issue? And then Robert says, this should be similar to absolute prosecutorial immunity and qualified immunity, where immunity is a bar to litigation. In that context, no discovery is permitted unless you can survive a motion to dismiss.
So, right. And taking the second one first, I think that analogy is helpful. And you've seen that a lot of federal appellate courts and state courts, that they've analogized to a type of qualified immunity. That's a type of immunity that most courts are familiar with. That's a threshold bar, not jurisdictional. Right. Qualified immunity and other types of immunities aren't necessarily jurisdictional, but they still have to be resolved at the outset of the case because the process of litigation would itself impinge upon the ability and the right of the organization that's at issue to govern its own affairs. Right. So if we're talking about police officers or other types of individuals, they need that immunity, at least to a certain extent, to be able to carry out their functions. And the churches need that as well. And if you tie them up for years in court, then that process is itself a form of punishment that will entangle both courts and potentially juries in religious questions and force, as the Fourth Circuit said in the Rayburn case back in the 1980s, force religious bodies to make their religious decisions with an eye not just on the flock, but also on the upcoming litigation and bureaucratic entanglement. So that's what the religion clauses are meant to kind of section off and protect. All right. So on the summary judgment question.
Can I just jump in real quick?
Oh, yeah.
Summary judgment. Yeah. Does it matter what type of immunity we're kind of analogizing church autonomy to? I mean, you know, you have qualified immunity, you have kind of 11th Amendment, sovereign immunity. There's kind of an immunity that arises out of the speech and debate clause for members of Congress. Does which immunity we kind of analogize make a difference, or do you think it probably they're all kind of interchangeable in that sense?
Well, I say yes and no, right? To a certain extent, for the point that we're discussing here, which is that the process itself is deleterious of the right, right? That you can use a number of different types of immunity to get the point across, and qualified immunity is helpful just because it's one that most folks are familiar with. But yeah, it can be a number of different types, and the weakness with qualified immunity, right, is that it's not necessarily textually rooted in the Constitution, unlike, say, sovereign immunity, and so sovereign immunity is a better parallel, or other types of separation of powers principles rooted in the Constitution are a better parallel to church autonomy doctrine, because church autonomy doctrine is rooted in the Constitution. It does place limits on the structural power of civil courts in our system. So the analogy is better. And actually the 10th Circuit pointed this out in the Bryce case back in 2002, right, where they said, yeah, it is kind of similar to qualified immunity, but it's different in that this isn't just a matter of administrative convenience for governmental officials. This is a matter of constitutional separation of powers between church and state. So it does matter. It just, you know, the analogy is helpful regardless.
And then on the summary judgment stage, when you have disputed issues of fact on the threshold issue, what?
Right. Okay. So the issue there is going to be, what's the disputed issue of fact, right? Is a disputed issue of fact? Well, I don't really think that sweeping the floors is religiously important, right? For most religious defendants, that will be true. For most religious defendants, you're going to win that one. And there won't be a real sincerity issue there, because you're not going to, you know, most religious defendants aren't going to say, oh, yeah. We want all of our ministers sweeping the floors. And so it's really religiously important to us that for resolution of the ministerial exception type question, that they swept the floors. But that's not true for every religious group. And so two really good cases out of the Ninth Circuit show this. One's called Alcazar, which we talked about earlier, and the other one's called Berend, which was just decided last summer. That dealt with the largest Zen Buddhist temple in the country. And in both of those cases, sweeping the floor was relevant to ministerial status, because it was a part of ministerial training, an important part of ministerial training. And there were lots of other things those individuals did as well, but maintenance functions and things that in the eyes of civil courts and some religious bodies would not be of religious significance. To those bodies, it was religiously significant. And so the real clear dividing line on something like that is going to be a question of sincerity. Do they really believe that this kind of function is important? And the Supreme Court in the Our Lady of Guadalupe case said that religious bodies are accorded a fair amount of deference when it comes to determining what is and is not important. Not complete deference. That's a kind of an open question, but a fair amount of deference. And so you see, for instance, when Catholic school teachers are saying, me teaching this religious stuff wasn't that religiously important. And then the church says, actually, we think it is. The courts have sided with the schools and the churches that have said, yeah, we think it is. Or in the Markle case that was just decided by the Ninth Circuit, in that case, you had a kosher food supervisor who said, all I'm doing is standing in a kitchen observing the making of wine. I don't have religious, you know, religious credentials. I don't have religious training. I'm not religious. And the court said, well, to the Orthodox Jewish organization that certifies you as able to provide kosher certification, you're very religious and it's very important to them. And we're not going to look behind that statement of religious belief.
Yeah. It seems like in a pluralistic religious society, you kind of have to do a more subjective analysis rather than kind of some objective test that this is purely secular and this is spiritual. I mean, I think that's what the Wisconsin Supreme Court ran into trouble with, that you kind of have to go religion by religion and make that determination.
Well, right. Well, just real quick, the Alito Kagan concurrence in Hosanna Tabor is really great on this and says, listen, there's kind of a shorthand for a lot of this. You can look at the major types of functions that a minister will perform for most religions, and that'll get you most of the way there. So if they're preaching the faith, they're teaching the faith, they're performing religious rituals or ceremonies, those kind of things, that makes it pretty clear we're talking about a minister. And then there are going to be some that don't look particularly traditional, but we still have to give room for sincere religious beliefs that look different in a country as religiously diverse as ours.
Yeah. Well, we're about out of time. Let me just ask one final question for you. Where do you see this all going? Is this just kind of a blip and these kinds of cases are going to go away? Or is this a new trend that churches are going to be dealing with for some time to come?
We're seeing more and more of claims like this where kind of folks are pushing back on the traditional governance decisions of the church. And a really good example of that is this question of tithing, where the money that's being disputed is money that was decided, sincerely decided by the church to put toward a particular purpose. And church members or former church members said, I want a federal court to say that you're wrong. That's unusual. It's not really happened before. In 1,000 years of Peter's Pence collections, we don't have any other cases that have said something like that before. And so this is a growing problem that will need resolution by the U.S. Supreme Court at some point in the future.
Well, thank you, everybody. More podcasts will be coming down the road from the FedSoc. So feel free to tune in and look at the FedSoc page, and there'll be more announcements of future events. Have a great day, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, y'all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.